Thank you. Good morning to you all. I'm excited, really excited about looking at the book of Daniel with you. I love this book. This is a really, really beautiful book and powerful when we understand the message that God has for us in each chapter. Would you turn with me to Daniel chapter 1? Daniel chapter 1. In just a second, I will read the chapter. So this is a story we're very familiar with. It's a story that maybe because of familiarity, we might actually sometimes ironically miss the point. And what I'm going to ask you to do in just a second, I will start reading Daniel chapter 1. And then maybe later I'll put some things up on the screen. As I will be reading, I want to ask you to look for three elements if you can. Okay, the three elements I'm looking for are three elements of a story. So part of the struggle we have with a chapter like this that we feel like we know, maybe because we know it or we think we know it, we miss things because we don't actually know the real point. We think, okay, I've got that one. I'm familiar with it. No, not really. Okay, in any story, you're going to have three things. And I think we probably, if you think about this, this makes sense. In any story, you'll have a hero. In any story, you'll have a conflict or a problem. And in any story, you'll have kind of a solution. Okay, you always have a hero just because, let's say, imagine a story with 17 people and they're all doing different things. And at the end, you're not sure who you're supposed to think about. Well, that's going to be confusing. Or you say, I don't think stories have problems. Why do I want I've got enough problems in my life. Why do I want problems in my stories? Well, think about a story that has no problems. Okay, so I'll tell you a story with no problems. Let's say George liked apples. George got up one morning. He bought an apple, he ate it, he ate the skin, he ate the flesh, he got to the core, he couldn't eat the core, so he threw it away. George liked apples, the end. This is not a story, right? Not a good one. Okay, there has to be a problem to make the story interesting, and you can make all kinds of problems, you know. George liked apples, George bought an apple, George took a big bite out of the apple, then he looked inside the apple and there was a worm. Not just any worm, but a worm without a head. And a worm that he realized had just lost its head. George no longer liked apples. Okay? You know, this, now we've got a story because we had a problem. The problem is called the worm. Okay, so what I'm looking for this story, I'm going to read it, Daniel chapter 1. I'm asking for us to look for those three things. Ask yourself, who is the hero of Daniel chapter 1? Oh, come on, that's easy. No, think about it. You might be wrong. Think about it. Who is the hero of Daniel chapter 1? What is the problem of Daniel chapter 1? And what was the solution? Who is the hero? What is the problem? And what is the solution? Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, we read. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the house of land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for that he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, to Hananiah of Shadrach, to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor, and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. Let them give us pulse to eat, water to drink. Then let our countenance be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat of the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. As for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge in skill and in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even under the first year of King Cyrus. Now, did you get the answers? You have it figured out. Who is the hero of the story? What is the problem of the story? What is the resolution? Who is the hero? What is the problem? And what is the resolution? Well, maybe you feel like I'm wasting your time. I'm giving you easy challenges. I mean, come on, give me a real challenge. Obviously, the hero of this story is Daniel. And so as you read down through the story, we could go that way. In fact, I could build the sermon this morning around verse 8. This phrase is really good. Verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart. And I could build the sermon around his courage, right? I mean, this took incredible faith, incredible belief, incredible courage to stand up and say, no, I will not eat the king's meat. And so we could carry on from there to point out that then God blessed Daniel. Look at Daniel. What a hero. What a guy. Daniel stood up and he was strong. He was courageous. And so the conclusion of the sermon, if we decided to go that way, would be, Daniel was strong, Daniel was courageous, Daniel was fearless, be like Daniel. Right? We could go that way. So Daniel would be the hero of the story. Now, I'm not going to minimize the fact that Daniel is quite heroic. Let's understand a little bit of the background here for starters. When we understand his situation, Daniel is only probably around 14 years old. Okay, anyone, I'm just curious, anyone here 14 years old? Anybody? Okay, high. Can you raise it higher? Like really high? Okay, Daniel is 14 years old. Not just that. Daniel has been removed from his complete surroundings. Okay, he has been literally ripped up from family, if we want to say it in New Testament terms, church, okay, his temple, his people around him, all of the influences in his life. And he has been carried away, far away actually, to a place where he's completely, completely removed from everything else. I mean, you can see this even in verse 7. The prince of the eunuchs gave them names, it says. And if you know about these names, each one of these names has a meaning. That, for instance, where you're talking about Daniel, okay, his name is a testimony to Israel's God. Guess what? They changed the name so that his name would be a testimony to Babylonian gods. So that you have meanings of names here in verse 7 that say Yahweh is God, and the new name they're given is the gods of the Babylonians are the true gods. So that every time you hear your name, you're hearing brainwashing. Naku is the name of one of these gods. Naku is God. Naku is God. Naku is God. Over and over again. How do you deal with that? Not just that. Think about all the reasons that they could have gone and followed another way. They could have decided that they are in a more advanced culture. They were. I mean, actually, Israel was kind of the backward or the more simple culture at this point. Babylon is the advanced place, the leader of the world. And they had incredible technologies. So you're a person from the backwoods small town, and suddenly you're brought to the big city, and it's the big culture with all their technologies. Really tempting now to give in and accept what they're saying. Not just this. As you go through, this is taken from a commentary I read that was really, really helpful. Seven reasons they could have just given in. Number one, they, by refusing the food, were resisting and insulting the king. Number two, everyone else was doing it. Number three, they would lose chances for advancement. You see, they're part of a group, and all the other people in the group, their same age, are all trying to be in a good position so that their future will be bright. Right? You want to be a good student. And so to refuse the king's meat, this is not going to be good. This was the best food in the land. You're turning away from the best food available, possibly in the world, to eat something really simple. They're 900 miles away from their biblical teachers. And here's where it really starts to kick. Since God had let them become captives anyway, why be faithful to God? Right? I mean, that's a tempting thought. God let us be carried away in this country, so that's his problem now. Now, in order to kind of one more in verse 10, just notice this is interesting. The prince of the eunuchs, okay, a Babylonian guy, says, "You would make me endanger my head to the king," meaning he's scared for his life. If he's scared for his life, Daniel better be scared for his life too, right? In other words, this is a matter of life and death. And this points to one question that I have to answer here, which is maybe something that's occurred to you. What's the big deal about food here anyway? Right. I from time to time I'll encounter people or have a discussion with somebody, and I'll get the impression somebody's thinking this is about nutrition, right? Because the pulse thing, that means vegetables. So vegetables and water. And so, you know, we live 2017, we're okay, yeah. My doctor has been telling me, eat more vegetables, drink more water, right? And so, yeah, I see. Daniel needs better nutrition. Okay. And so this is a nutrition thing. Let me say definitively, affirmatively, strongly, this is not about nutrition. This is definite. Sure, you should eat more vegetables and drink more water. That's not what's going on here. Definitely not. What's going on here is much simpler. God had given them commands, Old Testament commands, about the food that they were allowed to eat. Okay, if you want to get a sense of how strong this is, go to Acts 10 sometime and read the story with Peter and Cornelius, where God lowers down the sheet, right? And it's full of these different animals that were not permitted to eat. Okay? And Peter looks at these animals that came from God, and Peter says, "No, Lord, I won't eat that. I refuse to eat that." There were people in this era that died rather than eat a piece of pork. Okay. And if that sounds different for us, because, you know, we can freely eat these kinds of meats today. If that sounds odd to us, just remember, in that period of time, God had given that as a command. It was a matter of righteousness for them. Not for us, for them it was at that time. A lot of reasons for that, and I can't talk about that this morning. In fact, if you wanted to, you could take this class I talked about in Sunday school, because we'll discuss it there, discuss some of the reasons. But for Daniel, this would have been sin. Because this food was not prepared according to God's law. And so Daniel did show incredible heroism. Daniel did show incredible courage by saying no. Absolutely amazing. That is not the central point of the story. Daniel is not the hero of the story. What? It's Daniel. It says Daniel at the top of the page. Daniel is not the hero of the story. And the central conflict or problem of this story is connected to the food, but that's actually not the deepest and most significant conflict of this story. Who is the hero of this story? If it's not Daniel, well, okay, that leaves Hananiah, Mishael, no, that's all right, no. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar, no. Who else is left in the story? And the answer is so obvious that it's like missing the forest for the trees. It's right there. Who is the hero of the story? Really simple. His name is God. God is the hero of this story. You can see this all the way through. I paused when we got to the one of the verses that brings this out. Verse 9 very clearly tells us, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Right after this, verse 17, as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. Daniel had understanding in all these visions and dreams. And even when you get down to verse 20, though it does not mention God particularly, just think about these details. In all matters of wisdom and understanding, the king found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. Meaning, this is an advanced society, Babylon, probably the most advanced of its day. And if you go across the entire advanced society and you pick out the PhDs, these are the guys that in 2017, you know, would be the talking heads on television, the pundits, and they discuss and they've got all the information. These are the geniuses. These are the brains. These are the people that really have it together. If you found the smartest people of the kingdom, Daniel and his friends at maybe 17, 18 years old at this point, are 10 times smarter than the PhDs. This is not because of nutrition. This is not because they were diligent. Daniel was so diligent, he studied so hard. No. You don't get 10 times smarter than all the smartest PhDs at 17 by being diligent. That's just not the way life works. That's a miracle. This is a miracle. And when it talks about God giving Daniel in verse 17 skill and knowledge in all learning and wisdom, that's your clue. God gave him this. Who is the hero of the story? Standing behind it all, you and I see in front Daniel. We see his friends. We see what he's doing. There's something much deeper going on behind the scenes that throughout this entire story, God is the unseen hero of this story. And he emerges in different points at the plot, different points in the progress of the story, and he turns the story like a river where he wants it to go. God is in charge of this story. God is the hero of this story. Now, if he's the hero, what's the problem of the story? And that takes me back to the very first verse. You know what? One of the things that bothers me sometimes about the way we, and by we, I myself included, all of us, bothers me about the way that we read our Bibles. We read over verses sometimes kind of like they're extra. Kind of like that's sort of the little, you know, kind of like the credits at the end of the movie or the, you know, all the, it seems like it gets longer and longer now. All the different groups that are responsible for the movie at the beginning of the movie where you have like 5 minutes of logos coming up and really, really boring. And so that's just kind of the throwaway stuff. You're trying to get to the real story. And so we read through a story like this, and this is kind of, we won't admit it, but this is what's really going. In the third year, and the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs. Right? That's kind of the way we might be tempted to read the story. Get down to verse 3. That's the interesting. All this date stuff, I got done with that in 12th grade. I'm done with history. That's not true. That verse is there for a reason. Let's look at that and understand what it's saying. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, comes Nebuchadnezzar. Jehoiakim is the king of God's people. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of the pagans. And you can go back through the history of God's working with his people. Don't you remember? Don't you remember Pharaoh? The greatest power of his day. And you had this little band of disorganized people down there, a bunch of slaves. And God led them out with a mighty hand. And Egypt was vanquished. Right? The power of God, greater than any kingdom of the world. Don't you remember Jericho? What a city! Huge walls, nobody can touch it, and they all just fall flat and the people walk in. Because God is stronger than governments. God's people win, God's enemies lose. That's the way this works. God's people win, God's enemies lose. Don't you remember just very shortly before this story, the story of Sennacherib coming up against Israel, coming up against the kingdom of Judah, surrounding Jerusalem, and in one night, 185,000 Assyrians all perish. Right? Don't you remember that story? God's people win, God's enemies lose. Daniel chapter 1. God's people lost. And God's enemies won. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And not just that, but Nebuchadnezzar takes part of the vessels of the house of God. Don't you remember that story back with the Philistines? Where they capture the Ark of the Covenant and they take it down to their temple and they put it in their temple, and the next morning they get up and what happened? Their God is bowing before the Ark, right? Oh, wow, some kind of mistake. Okay, talk to the guy who built that art, that statue. Put the statue back up. Next morning, it's back on its face in front of... Don't you remember that story? Don't you remember how the Philistines start sending it around like a hot potato? And everywhere it goes, people get sick and things start falling apart. And they finally say, get it out of here. Don't you remember that ark? That same ark is on an ox cart. And somebody just reaches out and touches it and he's struck dead. These things are holy. You don't mess around with these things. Except in verse 2, now they're sitting in the temple of a pagan god. What happened to Israel's God? Has God fallen asleep? Has he forgotten his... Has God abandoned his people? Remember the covenant, the promise he made to Abraham. All the promises to Isaac and to Jacob. He said he would not ever turn away from those promises. Has God forgot his people? Whose side is God on? Is God there? Has God forgotten? Remember I said the hero of the story is God. And I told you that all the way through this story, God comes up in the plot and he's turning the story ever which way he wants. God is in control of this story. Do you believe me even when we have a catastrophe like this, that God is still in control? You should. Because Daniel chapter 1 verse 2 tells us that this was not an accident. The Lord did not fall asleep. God has not forgotten. Look at Daniel chapter 1, verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. God has not fallen asleep. God has not forgotten. God is in charge. In fact, God is still working, even in the catastrophe. Now, that brings me to the last thing I have to talk about, because didn't I say a story has a hero? We've decided that God is the hero of this story. And we said that a story has to have a problem or a conflict. And what we're seeing here is that the conflict really starts in verse 2 or verses 1 and 2. What has happened to God? Has God abandoned his people? Has God forgotten his promises? Has God given up on his people? And it continues. I would say still that yes, the issue of the food is part of this, because here's what's going on with this. It's not just what will Daniel do. Maybe that's the way we would typically. Daniel was heroic. He solved the problem by refusing to eat the king's food. It's not just that simple. The problem that's getting asked there, how do God's people remain faithful in a pagan country? How do God's people remain faithful when, from human standpoint, it looks like God has forgotten? Has God forgotten or not? What do God's people do? And the very simple answer here, this is where I can return to Daniel, and we can find real truth and bedrock in what he did. The answer is that in a difficult place, God's people turn to him. See, making Daniel the hero of the story, what a courageous guy. What a powerful, powerful guy. No, that's not it. Don't glorify Daniel. But yes, you can find challenge in the fact Daniel did not find power in himself. Daniel turned to his God. Daniel entrusted himself to his God. I say this because of this. When you get down to these verses, Daniel makes a request, verse 11 and 12, that the prince of the eunuchs would allow, actually all the way back in verse 8, that the prince of the eunuchs would allow them to have different food. And the idea here is, because he cannot eat this food, it's going to have blood in it, it's going to have shellfish or different kinds of seafood in it that he can't eat that food. Then the idea is, okay, I don't want them to think I'm rejecting their food, so I'll just go for the simplest food. Just give me vegetables. Just do that. And when he gets down to verse 12, think about this a little bit. This is, again, why we can't say it's about nutrition. In verse 12, I beseech thee, 10 days. Let them give us vegetables to eat for 10 days and water to drink. What Daniel proposed with this man was just a test of a week and a half. See, it can't be about nutrition. I mean, you know, it won't hurt if you eat better for a week and a half. But let's face it, losing weight, getting in shape, it just takes a lot longer. If it took a week and a half, we'd all look great, right? A week and a half is way too short. And so when Daniel proposes to him, give us just a week and a half and then evaluate how we're looking, that is an expression not of confidence in better nutrition, but that is an expression of faith. Daniel believes God will do a miracle. It's 10 days. Daniel believes in a miracle. And God working in response to that faith is the point of the story. God is still the hero of the story. He's using Daniel. Daniel's just placing his faith in God who will deliver and who will work. At the end of the 10 days, of course, that is exactly what happened. And so we get to the end of the story. And when you get down to verse 19, we've already read this. They stood before the king, it says in verse 19. What that means is they became kind of like his court counselors. They became part of the cabinet or something of the king. They became part of his advisors. In all matters of the wisdom, the king finds them so much wiser in all these different ways. And that's the way the story ends. Okay, question. Has the problem of the story been solved? Remember, we have a hero, it's God. We have a problem, and it's this question of verses 1 and 2. Has God forgotten his people? How will God's people live in a pagan land? And so the third element of the story is supposed to be a resolution. Question, has the problem been resolved yet? Well, sort of, kind of. Because it does turn out that they didn't have to eat the king's food. But I still have a question in the back of my mind that I haven't figured out yet. And that is, why did God allow this to happen in the first place? Why did God allow his people to go into bondage? Has God forgotten his people? See, that problem still bothers me. Did God just give them up? Did he reach a point and he said, forget you, I'm going to be on the side of the Babylonians from now on? Has God forgotten his people? And there's a surprise, and it's the last verse of the chapter. This is going to be a blessing to you. Ready? Daniel chapter 1, verse 21. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Now, that's like what I said earlier, isn't it? It's kind of like we read the credits, you know, or the credits at the end of the movie. Nobody watches that. So we read over the, it's just some date. Okay, Cyrus. Okay, keep on moving. But that's there for a reason. God doesn't waste words, right? In fact, if you're familiar with the Old Testament and you're familiar with some of the promises, you would know some things like this. You would know that Isaiah 44, more than 100 years before this time, in Isaiah's time, he prophesied, in the future, there will be a King Cyrus. This is like predicting the president in the year 2117. He predicted who the king would be and said his name, Cyrus. I call him by name. God predicted it. And God said, this person, Cyrus, who wasn't even born yet, this person, Cyrus, will deliver my people. He will return them to thy land. And if you keep on following this through, 2 Chronicles 36 records, Ezra chapter 1 records that Cyrus, this king, later on, after Daniel's time, would make a decree. Believe it or not, you can see it. Okay, if you ask me later, I'll show you a picture. You can see it online. You can search for it. I've seen it in person. It's in London. It's about this big. It's a rock. Okay, and it has all these squiggles all over it. I can't read it. But people who are smart and can have deciphered this and translated it. And what this thing says is that Cyrus, this king, Cyrus, made a decree that all the captives that had just sort of accumulated in the region of Babylon over the previous 100 years, Cyrus says, I'm sending them all back home. And Ezra records that Cyrus's decree was behind God's people going back to the land. And if you think about Ezra, you think about Nehemiah, they're rebuilding the city, they're rebuilding the temple. There is hope again. There is revival again. There are people that are rediscovering the law. There are people that are returning back to God, and it's putting things in place for the coming Messiah. And all of these things are still future, and they're hinging on the prophecy of Isaiah that there will be a king, Cyrus, who will give a decree and send God's people back to the land. In fact, here's where it gets even more amazing, honestly. If you go into some of the history, there's a historian, and this is not from the Bible, this is a secular historian, this who lived at the time of Christ. This historian records that the king Cyrus read the book of Isaiah, and he saw these words: "My will is that Cyrus, whom I have appointed to be king over many great nations, send back my people to their own land and build my own temple." He read, this historian records, Cyrus read those words that Isaiah had prophesied 140 years before this time. And when Cyrus read this and admired the divine power, I'm reading the quote now, he wanted to fulfill what was so written, so he called for the most eminent Jews that were in Babylon. Who do you think might have been some of the most important Jews in Babylon? Any guesses? Well, I keep on reading chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter, all the way to chapter 6. And by the time I get down to chapter 6, which is the time of Cyrus, I find out that Daniel is going to be one of three at the very top of the kingdom, and at that point becoming the second in command. And it's unthinkable that the second in command in the time of Cyrus doesn't know Cyrus, especially when we know that Cyrus consulted the most eminent Jews, the most important Jews that were in Babylon, about this verse. Meaning, when I get to the end of Daniel chapter 1 and God gives us this note, Daniel continued even unto the first year of the king of Cyrus, it's his way of saying to us, just so you know, Daniel was still alive when Cyrus, are you listening? When Cyrus became king, right? And the reader goes, Cyrus, the prophecy, this is him. What this tells us is that way back at the beginning of the chapter, when we read that Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem, he took the vessels of the house of God, he gathered some of the young men, the 13 and 14 year old men, took them out as captives, as refugees, and carried them off to his own kingdom. That dark part of the chapter where all the questions come to my mind and say, has God forgotten? Does God care? Has God given up on his people? No! Because even in his judgment on them for their sin, he was already preparing the way for their deliverance. That the sovereign hand of God put these young men in Babylon 70 years before. 70 years before, these young men are there in Babylon, and God knows, because there's something I want to do with Daniel when he's 85. And I take him to Babylon, and I put him there, and for 70 years, I promote and promote and promote him until 70 years from now, as an old man, I will have him in the perfect position to use Daniel and those around him to restore and bring back my people to the promised land in fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In keeping my word that I said I would use Cyrus to restore, I'm going to get Daniel involved in that, and I'm 70 years earlier in preparing that way. Even in the judgment, God is planting the seeds of the deliverance. Can I just end this morning then with these encouragements to us? God has not forgotten. The promises to Abraham, the promises to Jacob, the promises to Isaac, the promises to you, the promises to you in his word. God does not just say things and not do them. When God says he will do it, he does it every single time. God has not forgotten. What's more, I might find myself in a position where I see judgment. The road ahead looks dark. I don't see the answers to my questions. And sometimes I don't realize that God is preparing things, God is putting things in place that maybe he won't do until 70 years later. Do you think Daniel at 14 years old had any clue of the grandness of what God would do with him when he was 85? Of course not. And sometimes we see what God's doing, sometimes we don't. Sometimes God's working in our lives in ways that we have no clue. Maybe you'll see his plans. Maybe it'll be in your lifetime. Maybe it won't. I can tell you this much. God has not forgotten. God is working. The hero of the story is always God. And I would encourage us this way this morning. When you have questions, when you don't see the road ahead, when you don't know what God is doing, what's the simple solution? Daniel's response in this situation was to turn to God, the hero of the story. Place his faith in God, the hero of the story. Can you and I turn this morning in confidence? God has not forgotten. God has not lost control of the wheel of history. And even if my circumstances don't seem clear, God is very much in control. This morning, turn to him. Walk the step ahead. Go forward in faith. Go forward and do what he has told you is true. If he has said to do it, do it. Doesn't make sense. Do it. I don't understand. Do it. I don't know where this road ends. Just do it. God knows. He's in control. Walk the path that he has given you to walk. You have no idea what God is doing. No clue. But God is the hero of the story. God is always in control. And even sometimes, in the times that are the darkest, God is planting the seeds of his grand victory. Trust him. Go forward. Do what's right. And lay your situation before the feet of him who is always the hero of every story.